Welcome back to Whence Can You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back. This is episode number 411. In this episode, I've got actually a couple great papers that are more lengthy, and I have avoided doing this episode because they were longer papers, but that's not really a good excuse. I love the topic, and I wanted to put them together, and I just needed to find the right amount of time to sit down and really do these two papers justice. So this week on the program, I've got a couple pieces on my fave, Abraham Lincoln, and some of his connections to Freemasonry. And in these papers, we'll actually look at, again, his connections to Masons and answer some interesting facts about Lincoln and Freemasonry. Whether he didn't petition a lodge, withdrew his petition, addressing all of the rumors. So in the news, those of you who have been subscribed to the MasonicCon Chicago email letter, you know about our next featured speaker. So we did announce that Timothy Hogan was our first featured speaker at the event, or the one that we're announcing first. And we just announced the second to everybody out there who's listening who is not on that email list. You're going to want to get on that email list. Just go on over to MasonicConChicago.com, get on the list. And on Tuesday, so if you're listening to this on Sunday, then in just a couple days, you'll see the next speaker announcement, the one that you missed, come out on social media. So we'll have another video that'll come out, and it'll be pretty cool. Again, we're announcing speakers every 2 weeks. And in the interim, we're putting those announcements to social media. So kind of an exclusivity thing if you subscribe to the email list. I was asked, and so I did it. People wanted a Patreon. They like the Patreon format better than they like the PayPal subscription model. So I went ahead and started that. Now, I still do both. There still is a PayPal subscription model, or you can do Patreon. They both have the same perks. So a $2 contributor gets your name on the website, on the thanks page, WCY Fellow. That's a $5 per month donation that comes with your name on the site, as well as a thank you card from me, personally written. And then the producer, which is the all of those other benefits. Plus, I'm going to send you a pin, a lapel pin, which is the difference than it was before. So anybody who decides to do those things, those are the perks. You can check them out. And it's regardless whether you do it on Patreon or if you do it on PayPal subscriptions. So check out patreon.com/WCYpodcast, or just go to our website and check out how you can support us through PayPal as well. So currently, all of our subscription model PayPal folks who have helped us out are on the website. So thank you to all of those folks. But in addition, we want to give a shout out to Bill Short, DJ, Jose Venzer, Lucas Hess, and Stephen Johnston for your contributions. We can't do it without all of you guys, and it really makes a difference. And it's important for you all to know how I feel. And that is that this is a privilege to be able to do, and I want to thank you. And last but not least, I just want to mention that myself, as well as John Ruark, the co-author of It's Business Time, Adapting a Corporate Path for Freemasonry, he and I will be at Lodge of the Nine Sisters, number 773 in Raleigh, North Carolina, on September 21st. There will be a presentation by Brother John Ruark and then myself, or vice versa. I'll be doing Esoterics 101. Brother John will be doing another esoteric presentation, and there is a festive board as well. And I want to say that spouses are invited or welcome to go to the festive board also. So you'll want to check them out. You can search that lodge on Facebook and find the event and run your typical contacts so that you make sure everything is squared away before you visit. All right, let's get into this episode. Right after this. Now comes the point in the show where I ask you to help support this show. How do we do that? Well, we have a bunch of different ways to do that today. If you head on over to WCYpodcast.com, you can click on direct donation through PayPal, which we briefly touched on in the beginning of the program. Of course, you can make that one-time donation, or you can sign up to be a monthly contributor. Of course, we have a limited edition shop where you can pick up any number of items that come direct from us. Help us out by going to MasonicRevival.com, but also we have some other affiliates that are really important. Bankers Best, one of the most unique things we've ever done, is to work with Brother Levi Banker out of St. Louis, who owns his own company called Bankers Best Beard and Skincare. He's been so generous. If you head to WCYpodcast.com, click on More, then click on Banker's Best, and you can check out a bunch of the different products he's got. He's got a whole line of beard care products, skin care, oils, balms, all of this stuff, and he has been doing it a long time. He knows a lot about it. Everything is handmade, quality items. We even came up with the King Solomon's Reserve Beard Balm, which is a few years old now, but remains one of the great products that he still offers. Even the artwork on the bottle was done by a brother. The nice thing about this particular product is 50% of the proceeds come back to the program. If you're a history guy like me, then you'll be pleased to know that what makes the beard oil and balm very special is that it was made utilizing the fragrances specific to the exports of King Solomon's time and location, which is amazing. So black fig and honey is the formula. Luxurious scent, as Levi says, truly fit for our first Grand Master. If you use the promo code BBWCY357 at checkout, you'll also get a little bit of a percentage off. Please check that out. Bankers Best, or just head on over to buybankersbest.com. We also have a code that's on it. You can go to our website, click on More, then go to On It, and you can click through any of the links here, or just go to onit.com and use the promo code WCY at checkout. You'll get 10% off, and they'll send a little bit back to the program to help us out. And of course, it's business time. The book that I wrote with John T. Ruark, it is making some real waves, and people are using it and seeing success. So check that out on Amazon. You can click right to it. You can get it on Audible, Kindle, or in print, even on iBooks. And last but not least, I want to ask you to check out the Great Books program. You'll see the banner for it on the left-hand side, Intellectual Linear Progression. Use the promo code WCY, or you can just click on that link there, and you'll actually go right to the website and hear a little bit from Scott Hambrick about how awesome the program is. So that's it. I hope you guys enjoy, and thank you so much for helping us out. All right, so these two papers actually appear back-to-back in the same publication, and that is the Illinois Lodge of Research. Now, sometimes people are saying, hey, why do you read from the Illinois Lodge of Research all the time? Well, the great answer to that is that largely the work is good. Two, it is a resource that I have available. Three, it is a resource that I have where they have said that they were okay with me reading past transactions because perhaps it will invite somebody into thinking about membership in the Illinois Lodge of Research. So there's a lot of pluses to utilizing this research, but it's also just really good research for the most part. I also should mention that if you are interested in the Illinois Lodge of Research, the Grand Lodge Sessions for the Grand Lodge of the State of Illinois is coming up this October. Of course, I'm going to be there with most of my Lodge brothers from Space Novum, and I typically will go to the Lodge of Research meeting, which happens Saturday or Friday afternoon. I can't remember which. It's after sessions closes for the day, and there's usually a presentation as well as a brief business. So if you're going to be there, then come on out and check it out, and maybe it's something that you want to get involved in. But this is volume number 16, Illinois Lodge of Research, page number 8. James Adams and Abraham Lincoln by Wayne C. Temple. James Adams figured in the early saga of Abraham Lincoln's life in Springfield, Illinois, and yet he has left a rather beclouded image on the mirror of time. The son of Parmenio and Chloe Adams, he was born within Limsbury Township of Hartford County in Connecticut on January 24, 1783. About the year 1809, Adams married Harriet Denton, who had been born on January 31st, 1787. At this time, both resided in Orange County, New York, just northwest of New York City, the hometown of the bride. While in Orange County, New York, Lavinia was born to them on September 13, 1811, and died October 5, 1812. And Lavinia Eliza on May 3, 1813, who died on September 5, 1838. Becoming interested in Freemasonry, James Adams joined Washington Lodge No. 220 in Orange County and was raised a Master Mason on June 1, 1813. Shortly after getting his lambskin apron, the badge of a Mason, James Adams moved his family to Onondaga County, New York, and commenced to dabble in politics. By October of 1813, he was sitting as a Justice of the Peace for Lysander Township in that county. However, Adams was not admitted to the New York State Bar until October 11, 1817, while residing at Oswego. At that time, one need not be a lawyer to sit upon the bench. During their years in Onondaga and Oswego counties, the rest of the Adams children were delivered. Charlotte Baldwin on May 2, 1815, died January 10, 1832. Lucien Bonaparte on December 10, 1816, died February 17, 1882. And Vienna Margaret on July 10, 1818, and who died on February 12, 1844. By 1815, Adams had become associated in some capacity with the 16th Infantry Regiment of the New York State Militia. He later had a connection with Captain David Scott's company in the 23rd Infantry Regiment, yet it is not certain that he actually fought in the War of 1812, as some have asserted. The only James Adams in the United States regular service who survived this conflict and applied for bounty land was a member of Romaine's Artillery. However, it is a fact that on July 8, 1816, through politics, Governor Daniel D. Tompkins appointed Adams to be colonel of the 172nd Regiment of the Infantry in the New York State Militia. Governor DeWitt Clinton promoted Adams to Brevet Brigadier General of the 45th Brigade of Infantry in the New York State Militia on September 5, 1817. Thereafter, he always referred to himself as General Adams. Then, Governor Clinton advanced him to be a full Brigadier General of the 48th Brigade of Infantry on April 24, 1818. This unit was composed of men in Oswego and Onondaga counties. Although it has been claimed that James Adams fought in not only the War of 1812, but also years later in both of the Winnebago and Black Hawk Wars while a resident of Springfield, Illinois, such is not the case. Only in 1831 did he even draw 17 days' salary as an inspector of troops. Even then, he remained a civilian. In those days, inspectors were gentlemen with political influence who were employed by the state of Illinois to examine or even compile muster rolls, etc. On June 1, 1818, Governor Clinton presented James Adams with another political plum, road commissioner for the Westmoreland and Sodus Bay Turnpike Company. Unfortunately, however, 1818 would not be a good year for General Adams. On October 6th, the Court of General Sessions at Oswego indicted him for forgery of a deed record. The document in question had been drawn up back on December 20th, 1816, for Lot 72 in the town of Hannibal, later called Granby in Oswego County. Adams, of course, posted bail and was released until a petite jury could try the case. But General Adams did not remain for trial in Oswego. No, he immediately fled home, leaving his family behind. James Adams turned up in Baldwinsville, Lysander Township, Onondaga County, soon after he disappeared from Oswego. There he began clerking in a mercantile business owned by J.C. Baldwin. Perhaps the minions of the law eventually heard rumors of his whereabouts, because he left Baldwinsville on June 7, 1820. With a letter of recommendation from his employer. Adams's new destination was the new state of Illinois. By December 11, 1820, he had taken the first steps toward becoming an attorney in Illinois. John Reynolds and Joseph Phillip, members of the Illinois Supreme Court, then examined James Adams, gentleman, as to his qualifications and licensed him to be a counselor at law on August 15, 1821. Federal Judge Nathaniel Pope next licensed Adams to practice in his federal court on October 21st that same year. Since the spring of 1821, Adams had been living in the newly founded little village of Springfield, by now the county seat of Sangamon County. His family later joined him at his house on the southwest corner of 4th and Jefferson. In politics, he labored as an ardent Democrat and quickly began to devote much of his time and money to this party. At some later date, he was baptized into the Christian church at a revival meeting. He also expressed a deep interest in masonry, never hiding the fact that he had been a mason in New York State. When Sangamon Lodge No. 9 of Springfield was consecrated, he dedicated and installed on June 24, 1823, under a charter from the Grand Lodge of Missouri, James Adams served as Grand Secretary and Grand Chaplain pro tem. In other words, he was standing in for Missouri Grand Lodge officers who were not present for the ceremony. But Sangamon Lodge No. 9 became, quote-unquote, arrested on April 11, 1826, as a result of the anti-Masonic furor over the William Morgan affair. When this turmoil died down, Masons in Springfield once more petitioned the Grand Lodge of Missouri on January 27, 1839, for a charter. Among those signing was James Adams, who swore that he had been a member of the lodge at Skaneateles, New York, its number, quote-unquote, not recollected. It is almost unthinkable that a Mason would ever forget his lodge number, nor does the Grand Lodge have a record of his membership there. Skaneateles lies in Onondaga County. A dispensation to form Springfield Lodge No. 26 was granted on February 25th with James Adams named as the master. These Masons met on April 20th with Adams in the master's chair. The officers were officially installed on April 25th. Then, on the 25th of December in 1839, the regular election took place. Dr. Meredith Helm, 1802-1866, a physician, became master and moved into the East. James Adams assumed the junior warden station. To reward his assistance in organizing No. 26, the brothers ordered that a committee procure a silver cup to cost not less than $20 for Brother Adams as a quote-unquote token of respect and esteem. It was duly presented to him in Lodge on February 13, 1840. On November 18, 1839, the Lodge had named him one of three officers to attend a convention of Illinois Lodges at Jacksonville on December 27th to prepare for the formation of a Grand Lodge in Illinois. After several meetings, the Grand Lodge of Illinois was established at Jacksonville on April 6, 1840. James Adams was elected Right Worshipful Deputy Grand Master. Then, on October 21, 1840, the Grand Master appointed Lucien Bonaparte Adams to be the Grand Steward. In that same year, Stephen A. Douglas was chosen as the Grand Orator, indicating the qualifications generally required for such an appointment to the Grand Line. By April 19, 1841, the Springfield Lodge, now called No. 4 in the Grand Lodge of Illinois, was ready to dissolve because of the interference of James Adams. He finally promised to withdraw from the decision-making, and the lodge survived. And when the Grand Lodge convened at Jacksonville on October 4, 1841, James Adams was conspicuously absent. However, he sent a communication which was not entered into the minutes, but only referred to a committee. What it said, we do not know today. We do know that he was not nominated for an office that year. Dr. Meredith Helm of Springfield became the new Deputy Grand Master. James Adams' name is not on the membership list of No. 4, and his son, L.B. Adams, took a demit from this lodge, but later joined Central No. 71 when it was formed in Springfield, became a steward in that body. Thus, James Adams dropped out of the Masonic fraternity without an official hint of his true reason. He simply is not listed after this time, but he was actively engaged with the Mormons at Nouveau, and perhaps advised Joseph Smith on the subject of Masonry, which the prophet decided to join. By this date, James Adams was acquiring a rather unsavory reputation in Springfield. Within a short time after his arrival in Springfield, James Adams gained the political backing of the Democratic Party. He sought an appointive office, and the House of Representatives meeting at Vidalia resolved that James Adams be appointed a Justice of the Peace for Sangamon County. On January 7, 1823, the Senate confirmed his nomination. He was duly commissioned on January 14th. In those years, the office was not elective. To supplement his judicial income, Adams gained permission on January 24th, 1823, to construct a toll bridge across the Sangamon River, within 1 mile of Fancy Creek's mouth. Again, in 1825, the legislature named Adams to a lucrative post. On January 12th, it selected him to be the judge of probate in Sangamon County, and his commission was issued on January 18th. Certainly, the General Assembly had no knowledge of his past record as a judge back in Oswego, New York. Yet, how much time Adams actually spent in Springfield at this time is unknown. On April 9, 1825, John McLean, the Postmaster General of the United States, appointed him Postmaster of Peoria, Peoria County, Illinois. Peoria County had been established by the Illinois General Assembly on January 13, 1825. Of course, he may have hired a clerk to run the post office for him. Such a practice was not unknown, even in later days. Being extremely ambitious in the political field, Adams ran for lieutenant governor on August 7, 1826, but was defeated. When he sought election as justice of the peace in Sangamon County at the hands of the residents this time, he received only 37 votes on August 6, 1827. The winner garnered 184 votes. Undaunted, he again sought the office of lieutenant governor on August 2, 1830, with the same general results as in 1826. Nevertheless, he ran for governor on August 4, 1834, without success. Then he wanted to be the recorder of deeds in Sangamon County, but was unsuccessful on August 3, 1835. While still a resident of New Salem, Abraham Lincoln would have learned about James Adams. On May 21, 1836, Lincoln certified his survey for the proposed town of Huron, located approximately 30 miles northwest of Springfield on the Sangamon River. Its proprietors were Stephen T. Logan, James Adams, Gershom Jayne, John T. Stewart, David Prickett, Simeon Francis, Ninian Wirt Edwards, Samuel Morris, W.M. Carpenter, George Miller, and S.H. Treat. Adams and two other proprietors were authorized to sell lots prior to the public sale to be held at Huron on April 20, 1836. Then, beginning on May 21, 1836, James Adams commenced to purchase land directly from the federal government for $1.25 per acre, cash money. He accumulated quite a holding of this cheap land. By an act in force on March 4, 1837, the Illinois General Assembly repealed the old law concerning probate courts approved back on January 2, 1829. This new legislation provided for the election of probate justices of the peace in the counties. An election for such offices was to be held on August 7, 1837, but after 1839, the term was to be 4 years instead of two. Adams immediately sought this office, and so did Dr. Anson Gordon Henry, a state house commissioner, as well as Abraham Lincoln's personal physician and political ally, Dr. Henry, 1804 to 1865. He would later become a master mason in Pekin Lodge No. 29 in 1847. Since the Democrats had attacked Dr. Henry's management of the new Capitol construction in Springfield, the Whigs, now determined to examine minutely the activities of James Adams, a Democrat who had probably authored some of the attacks on Dr. Henry. Beginning on June 17, 1837, the Sangamon Journal started a series of anonymous articles which were signed Samson's Ghost, purporting to be from a deceased man, Andrew Sampson, who had once owned the land where Judge Adams resided. In all six of these letters, appeared prior to the election, Samson's Ghost accused Adams of fraudulent acquisition of private land and declared that even his own house sat upon disputed ground. Finally, Samson's Ghost revealed that Adams had also cheated the widow of Joseph Anderson out of the tract of land by compiling a forged mortgage. These weekly letters were probably jointly composed by Abraham Lincoln, Edward Dickinson Baker, Stephen Trigg Logan, and John Todd Stewart. Naturally, Adams replied that he had been wronged and slandered. Just 2 days before the election, Abraham Lincoln circulated a signed handbill against Adams. In fact, Stewart and Lincoln had already publicly filed a court suit against Adams to recover the property for the widow of Joseph Anderson. Despite these startling charges, James Anderson rather easily defeated Dr. Anson G. Henry for probate justice of the peace on August 7, 1837. Adams piled up 1,025 votes to Henry's 792 and was duly commissioned on September 11th. Sangamon County lay largely on the hands of the Democratic electors, and to defeat their candidates proved nearly impossible no matter what the issue might be. Even Abraham Lincoln did not carry Sangamon when he ran for president in 1860 and 1864. With dogged determination, however, Lincoln and his fellow Whigs pursued their investigation of Adams. Lincoln especially needed ammunition for his legal case against Adams. Dr. Henry, no doubt, helped. He had been born in Oswego County, New York, the former residence of Adams, and certainly had loyal friends still there. Finally, the local Whig leaders obtained a certified copy of the indictment of James Adams back in Oswego for forgery of deeds and records. They immediately had this document published in the Sangamon Journal on November 25, 1837, page 2, columns 1 through 3. Although this scandal made most interesting reading, it was, of course, much too late to influence the election, now long past. Still, Lincoln proceeded to add to Adams's discomfort. He concocted one of his droll theories and passed it around the community. According to his tale, Lincoln himself had been traveling towards Springfield several years previously when he chanced to encounter a resident of Springfield on the same road, heading away from town. "Good evening, friend," said Lincoln. "How far is it to Springfield?" "Well, I guess it's about 5 miles," the other answered. "Are you just from there?"
"I am."
"What's the news there?" Lincoln asked.
"Well," the Springfielder replied, "there's nothing of any account but a sad accident that happened the other day. You don't know General Adams?"
"Well, the general went to stoop down to pick up some blackberries, and John Taylor's calf gave him a butt right."
"You don't say so.
And did the general die?"
"No, by God, but the calf did."
This ridiculous joke probably caused General Adams more pain than the newspaper attacks made upon him by Lincoln and his political colleagues. He certainly never forgave Lincoln for his part in the whole Samson's ghost matter. And within a year, Adams would attempt to embarrass Lincoln in his court. David and Nancy Cloyd had moved to the state of Illinois from Kentucky in October of 1825. They squatted upon land in Curran Township of Sangamon County, and on March 22, 1827, they purchased from the Federal Land Office at Springfield the east half of the northeast quarter in Section 25 of Township 15 North, Range 6, west of the third principal meridian, 80 acres, for the standard government cash price of $1.25 per acre. Later, David Cloyd died on March 31, 1838, without leaving a will. Since he had succumbed interstate, his estate went into the probate court of Judge James Adams for settlement. Of the three identifiable children of the deceased, Thomas, Samuel, and Mary, called Polly, the judge selected Mary's husband, Henry Lucas, to administer the estate. Because a $1,000 bond had to be executed before the administrator could commence his labors, two other townfolk were asked to sign Henry Lucas's bond. Thomas M. Neal and Abraham Lincoln, both surveyors, affixed their signatures to the bond, no doubt at the request of Lucas, on August 21, 1838. By the way, this document adds another very early date to Lincoln's life and is not recorded in Lincoln's Day by Day. Now, we must make a supposition as to what happened next when the document was returned to Judge Adams. It would seem that Judge Adams took one look at Lincoln's name on the bond and immediately scratched it out with a great bold stroke. He probably scolded Abraham Lincoln and reminded him that he still owed monetary debts from his New Salem mercantile adventures and in no way possessed any part of $1,000. The name of George Bridges was then substituted right below the deleted A. Lincoln. Bridges had been born during 1793 in Kentucky and came to Curran Township of Sangamon County in 1835, thus being a neighbor of the Cloyds. Bridges died in 1849. In due course, George Bridges himself wrote his name on the document. Naturally, being the owner of a farm, he did have at least the portion of $1,000 necessary
to Bond Henry Lucas. The name A. Lincoln on the second line of the Bond's first page probably was not inscribed by Lincoln himself, nor is the name A. Lincoln written on the outside fold of the manuscript from Lincoln's pen. However, his signature entered near the top of the second page, technically the verso of the first page. And those of Henry Lucas, T.M. Neal, and George Bridges are all genuine signatures of the men involved. Although scratched out, there is not a doubt that it was written by Lincoln's own hand. Also note that the hand which inscribed the name of Thomas M. Neal in two other places misspelled it. Yet Neal's name at the end of the bond was written correctly by Neal himself, just as Lincoln, Lucas, and Bridges had personally inscribed theirs too. On August 5, 1839, James Adams again ran for re-election as probate justice of the peace in Sangamon County. This time his opponent proved to be Robert L. Wilson, who had recently been a member of the well-known Long Nine delegation from Sangamon County to the General Assembly, a group which included Abraham Lincoln. When the votes were tabulated, it was found that Adams had been beaten by Wilson by a mere 38 ballots. Adams received 1,183 and Wilson 1,145. The governor issued his commission on August 27th. It would appear that local Democrats voted for their own nominees no matter what came up to sully their reputations. Nevertheless, coming events would drastically change the course of James Adams's life. By the fall of 1849, he had been baptized into the Mormon Church. One issue of a newspaper at Nouveau, Times and Seasons, on January 15, 1841, announced boldly that James Adams had joined their ranks officially. He became an intimate confidant of Joseph Smith. In fact, he was declared the surrogate father of the prophet. Adams began to spend more and more time among the Mormons at Nouveau. Perhaps because of his great wealth and his influence with these Mormons, James Adams was named, by a law approved on February 23, 1841, a commissioner to sell stock for the Springfield Marine and Fire Insurance Company. In Nauvoo, Adams thought that he could start his career anew after all of the unfavorable publicity which had surfaced against him in Springfield. Anyway, he was elevated to high priest in the Mormon religion, and on May 4, 1842, received one of the very first endowments to the incomplete temple at the very hands of Joseph Smith. In return, Adams presented the church with 11 quarter sections of land. As high priest and patriarch of the church, Adams commenced performing the religious ceremonies which resulted in plural marriages for Joseph Smith. Then, on July 11, 1843, Adams himself took another wife, Roxina Repshire. There is no record that his legal wife, Harriet in Springfield, ever knew of James's infidelities to her. She remained in the capital city. Finally, James Adams determined to quit Springfield permanently and make Nauvoo his residence. Although not even a legal inhabitant, Hancock County, James Adams entered the race for probate justice of the peace in that jurisdiction on August 7, 1843, and was elected by a comfortable margin, indicating that he had the blessings of the Mormon Church for this adventure. However, his election started a wave of indignation in the county and the state. He was never commissioned and died in Nauvoo as a result of cholera on August 11, 1843. Nauvoo's Masonic Lodge, largely a Mormon body, while under dispensation from the Grand Lodge and without a charter, buried Adams with full Masonic honors on August 16th. Thus passed away from this earth an old nemesis of Abraham Lincoln and the Whig Party of Illinois. Harriet Adams remained in Springfield until she too expired on August 21, 1844. James Adams left his family in excellent financial condition. When he made his will on May 5, 1838, he owned lands in Illinois, New York, Missouri, and Texas. He established a trust and decreed that when the fund equaled $1 million, a university building of cut stone was to be erected in the southwest fractional quarter of Section 14 in Township 33, North Range 1, east of the 3rd Prime Meridian. This land lay on the eastern outskirts of LaSalle, Illinois. He directed in his will that this university teach arts, sciences, and languages with non-sectarian teachers and have a primary school on the grounds as well. He envisioned the building to be 4 stories high, with an astronomical observatory on the roof. It is not known that such a university was ever established. but it is interesting to note that a justice of the peace could accumulate such a large estate from an income supposedly acquired by only small fees. Only his son, Lucien Bonaparte Adams, who inherited a large amount of cash and books, survived for a long period of years after his father's demise. He had married Marjorie A. Reed on March 14, 1824 in Springfield. Lucien became a lawyer and a United States commissioner in the federal courts while residing at 305 Madison Street, where he died at 7:30 a.m. on February 17, 1882, as a result of typhoid fever and pneumonia. Unlike his sire, Lucien attended the Presbyterian Church. At his death, a local paper called him an honest, upright, law-abiding citizen of Springfield. He was not a member of Central Lodge No. 71 when he died. So, holy cow, this guy, James Adams, sounds like a massive dirtbag. I don't really know how to put that otherwise. And if you know anything about Abraham Lincoln and you've read books on Lincoln, as I have, you know that Lincoln has also been egregious at times in terms of his political ruthlessness. But what's also interesting is this tie back to the lodges of Nouveau and supposed Masonic connections. If you listen to past episodes about Joseph Smith and the lodge down in Nouveau, it's really ambiguous about what was going on down there. Some folks say that the lodge at Nauvoo was shut down because they were raising women. Some say it was shut down because they were raising hundreds of people at a time. Who knows? Maybe Joseph Smith is the father of modern blue lightnings or modern one-day classes. And then, you know, subsequently they pulled the charter of that lodge. And yet they just kept on operating like they didn't really care. Pretty interesting stuff. Cool paper. I hope you enjoyed. And I should also mention that for the folks who have our app, right? So if you go to Podcast Source and you download Whence Came You and make that part of your listening experience, it's totally free. But I will have the PDFs that I'll scan in and you guys can have those. It has all of the references. And so there are about 60 citations for this particular paper. And I'm not going to read them all, so they'll just be in the app if you want to download and find out. You'll have the whole paper as well as all the citations right there for you.
And now the next piece, again, Volume 16, Illinois Lodge of Research, page number 14. We're going to continue the thread, but this time instead of just having a little bit about Abe Lincoln, you know, peppered in, this one is called Abraham and Freemasonry by Paul M. Bessel. Published back in 1994 in November. And I think the reason that they mention that is because they likely are publishing something that was published somewhere else and republished it in the Illinois Lodge of Research when they didn't have enough content. Abraham Lincoln was not a Mason, but he possessed and displayed all the important qualities of Freemasonry: faith, hope, and charity, belief in a God, the equality of all people, and the ability of each person to improve. He came into contact with many Masons, and Freemasonry was a greater influence in society than today. What then was his view of Masonry? And would he and Masonry have benefited from his membership? Why did he not become a Mason? How did Masonry affect his life and career? Lincoln's attitude toward Freemasonry. How Lincoln and Freemasonry would have benefited from his membership. Direct evidence about Lincoln and Masonry. The Grand Lodge of Illinois recessed their meeting being held during the 1860 presidential campaign to call on Abraham Lincoln, a candidate in that election. And he is reported to have said, "Gentlemen, I have always entertained a profound respect for the Masonic fraternity and have long cherished a desire to become a member." End quote. When Masons told Lincoln in a conversation during that campaign that all his opponents were Freemasons, especially noting that Stephen A. Douglas was an early member of the Masonic Lodge in Springfield, Lincoln's hometown, and he was not, Lincoln replied, "I am not a Freemason, Dr. Morris, though I have great respect for the institution." After Lincoln's death, the Grand Master of Masons in the District of Columbia, Benjamin B. French, who had been a friend of Lincoln's, wrote to the editor of the Masonic Trowel, who was also the Grand Secretary of the Grand Lodge of Illinois. He, Lincoln, once told me how highly he respected our order.
and that he, at one time, had fully made up his mind to apply for admission into it." End quote. Brother French also wrote to the Deputy Grand Master of the Grand Lodge of New York in response to a similar inquiry, quote, "President Lincoln once told me, in the presence of Most Worshipful Brother J.W. Simmons, that he had at one time made up his mind to apply for admission to our fraternity, but he feared he was too lazy to attend to his duty as a Mason as he should like to do, and that he had not carried out his intentions." End quote. Carl Sandburg said, in a chapter about Lincoln's political activities in his biography of Lincoln, quote, "Though not a Mason, he, Lincoln, had at hand a personal copy of the bound Proceedings of the Grand Royal Arch Chapter of the State of Illinois, being reports of conventions of the Masonic Order for the years 1851 to 1857, end quote. Why Lincoln should have been a Mason. There are many reasons for Lincoln to have had a positive view of Freemasonry. A qualification to become a Mason is a belief in a supreme being, while leaving it to each one to decide exactly what religious beliefs to hold. And Masonic ritual includes many references to the Bible and the concept of spiritual rebirth. Lincoln, too, had a fervent belief in God. He was an avid student of the Bible and included biblical references in many of his writings and speeches, the most famous being his second inaugural address. And he regarded the entire subject of religion as a matter of individual conscience. Lincoln could have been expected to have been attracted to Freemasonry's attitude of support for religion combined with a strong support of freedom of religion and conscience for all people. Spiritual rebirth was one of the special concepts alluded to in Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. One of the fundamental tenets of Masonry is that it seeks, quote-unquote, to make good men better. This belief would have appealed to Abraham Lincoln, who desired to see the best in people, and to see that each individual could advance in life as much as possible. Likewise, the Masonic support of equality and the brotherhood of all people were also fundamental ideals with Lincoln. Masonry examines the meaning of death, and Lincoln frequently meditated on this. Freemasonry in the 1800s, even more than now, focuses on philosophy. What are the long-term purposes and goals of our lives? Lincoln, who talked of America as being a beacon of hope for mankind, and who said the goal of the Civil War was to ensure that free government would survive in the world, would have been interested in this Masonic tradition. There are more mundane reasons to think that Abraham Lincoln should have been a Mason. Freemasonry and other fraternal organizations are typical places for politicians to become well known. Lincoln was one of the most ambitious politicians of his day, and he could have benefited from this connection. Lincoln also had an active law practice, and if he had been a Mason, more people might have come to know and appreciate his legal abilities. Another reason to think Lincoln should have wanted to become a Mason is his desire for fellowship. Lincoln enjoyed the company of other men and strongly desired acceptance from society. He should have welcomed the opportunity to be with men who are such close friends as to consider themselves Masonic brothers. He would have had the opportunity to share humorous stories, discuss philosophical issues, and exchange information about their experiences. Lincoln enjoyed politics in all its senses, and he would have likely risen to a prominent office within Freemasonry. That would have satisfied his ambition in some way, as well as helping him achieve prominence in the community. It would have shown, as Lincoln did in other ways, that one born without any likely prospects for success in life could achieve much that even those who were more high-born did not. Lincoln's relations with individual Masons. Lincoln's personal associations should have led him to seek to join the Freemasons. Bowling Green was a close friend of Lincoln and one of the most prominent men in New Salem, Illinois, Lincoln's first hometown. Green, who was also a master of the local Masonic Lodge and a member of the original Grand Lodge of Illinois. Mrs. Green and Green's Masonic brethren requested that Lincoln speak at Judge Green's funeral, which included Masonic services, in February of 1842, and Springfield Lodge No. 4 invited Lincoln to give a speech at a memorial service for Green in September, as described by Carl Sandburg. Quote, "One day there came news that hurt Lincoln. Bowling Green was dead. Lincoln rode out to the Green home. He stayed till the day of the funeral. Though he was not a Freemason, word came to him that the Masons who were to conduct the funeral wished him to make some remarks on the character and life of Bowling Green. On the day of the burial, the Masons in white aprons gathered in the Green cabin. the chaplain carrying the open Bible, the Tyler, his drawn sword, and other regalia of the Masonic Brotherhood. The master of ceremonies finally called Lincoln to the head of the coffin, end quote. Besides Bowling Green, many of the important men of New Salem, Springfield, and nearby areas with whom Lincoln was in contact were Masons, including Stephen A. Douglas, who was an active member of the Masonic Lodge in Springfield, Ninian Edwards, and James Shields. The best man at Abraham Lincoln's wedding to Mary Todd was James Matheny, a member of Springfield Masonic Lodge and a past master of the Grand Lodge of Illinois. Lincoln's closest neighbor, James Gourley, was also a Mason, as were other friends and business associates. Even the fiancée of Anne Rutledge, reported to be Abraham Lincoln's first true love, was junior warden of a local Masonic lodge. Thus, it is clear that Abraham Lincoln was familiar with many Masons, saw Masonry in action, and at least during the funeral of his good friend Bowling Green, and therefore it cannot be said that Lincoln did not seek to become a Mason, because he was not familiar with Freemasonry. Lincoln's idol in politics was Henry Clay, a U.S. Senator and Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, candidate for president several times, and one of the most influential Americans of the first half of the 1800s. Henry Clay was the Grand Master of Masons in Kentucky in 1820 and 1821. It should be noted, though, that in 1830 and 1831, during the height of the influence of the anti-Masonic Party in American politics, Clay said he had been inactive for many years. Clay was then seeking the presidency. He might have helped his chances by specifically denouncing Masonry, but he refused to do that. Since Henry Clay was Lincoln's role model in politics, it would be reasonable to expect that Lincoln would have been influenced by Clay's Masonic involvement. Rising to the level of Grand Master in Kentucky, and Clay's refusal to denounce Masonry, even when that action could have helped him politically, to join the Masons and seek a leadership position, if only to help himself politically. For many reasons, then, one would think that Lincoln should have wanted to become a Mason, and that he would have been welcomed if he had applied. He said he had a favorable attitude towards Freemasonry. His words and actions showed a devotion to the ideals similar to those in Masonry. The philosophy of Masonry is similar to the beliefs Lincoln supported. Membership in the Masons probably would have helped Lincoln in his political and legal careers and would have bolstered his desire to be accepted by others and enjoy a friendly fellowship, and Lincoln came into contact with and admired many Masons. Becoming a Mason was, in Lincoln's time, a normal action for community leaders with political ambitions, especially those like Lincoln, who thought about the deeper meaning of life. Why didn't Lincoln become a Mason? Speculation on the reasons Lincoln did not become a Mason falls into several categories. Reasons given by Lincoln and those who knew him. Lincoln is reported to have told the members of Grand Lodge of Illinois during 1860 campaign for U.S. President that, quote, "I have never petitioned because I have felt my own unworthiness to do so. I might be overcoming my hesitance and be petitioning at the present time, but I am a candidate for political office, and by such action would be misconstrued. For this reason, because my motives would be misconstrued, I must, for the present time, refrain." End quote. After Lincoln's death, a friend of his, who was a prominent Mason, said Lincoln had once told him that the reason he did not seek membership in Freemasonry was that, quote, "I, Lincoln, feared that I was too lazy to do all my duty as I should wish to were I a member, and I have kept postponing my application," end quote. When the friend said it was not too late, Lincoln laughingly replied, "Well, perhaps someday I may ask you to let me in," end quote. Mary Todd Lincoln replied in October of 1860 to a letter from a minister who was a member of an anti-Masonic faction in the Ohio Republican Party, who said he would not support Lincoln unless he could be convinced that Lincoln had never belonged to a secret society. She said, quote, "Mr. Lincoln has never been a Mason or belonged to any secret order since he has been a man. He has no time to devote to anything out of the line of his business, even if he had been so disposed," end quote. Edwin M. Stanton, Lincoln's Secretary of War, was an avid Freemason. He wrote that he once elicited Lincoln's views of Masonry, and Lincoln was noncommittal. Perhaps Lincoln did not have a strong feeling, either way, about joining the Masons. Lincoln might have avoided Masonry because of unfortunate but interesting incidents with a couple of Masons, Lincoln and James Adams. In May 1837, Lincoln took on one of his first legal cases representing the widow and son of Joseph Anderson in their effort to take possession and sell 10 acres of land presumed to have been owned by him at the time of his death. However, James Adams, Anderson's former attorney and an officer in the Springfield Masonic Lodge, was found to be in possession of the land, bashing his claims on a deed executed to him by Anderson. Lincoln felt the conveyance of this land was spurious. At the time of this lawsuit, Adams was running as a Democrat for probate justice of the peace in Sangamon County against the Whig friend of Lincoln's. During the campaign, 6 letters were printed in a local newspaper written by Lincoln and insinuating fraud by Adams, and a few days before the election, Lincoln wrote and distributed handbills in Springfield which stated explicitly that Adams obtained Anderson land by fraud. Adams responded to these charges, and Lincoln, in turn, published replies. The affair was bitter and public. Lincoln said Adams spread rumors that Lincoln was a deist, rumors that caused Lincoln political harm in the future. In the meantime, Adams won the election, and the contested land was still in Adams's estate when he died 6 years later. James Adams was a master of the Springfield Lodge in 1839, was elected Deputy Grand Master of Masons in Illinois in 1840. Lincoln might not have wanted to join a lodge in which Adams was a prominent member, and Lincoln might not have received unanimous approval to be accepted into the Springfield Lodge after his 1837 run-ins with the prominent Mason James Adams. Lincoln and James Shields. A few years later, Lincoln had problems with another Mason, James Shields. He was an Irish immigrant who settled in Illinois and became an active Mason in January of 1841. Shields was a Democrat who became state auditor in 1841. Lincoln and the Whig Party protested his policies, and several satirical letters appeared in the Springfield newspaper questioning Shields' honesty and mocking his physical courage. Shields was told that Lincoln had written these letters, and he challenged Lincoln to a duel. All of Springfield read Shields' published challenge, and there was a great excitement about the upcoming duel. Lincoln attempted to end the dispute with a partial explanation, but said if a duel was insisted on, then he, as the person challenged, would demand that both combatants be in an 8-foot circle, holding the largest possible cavalry broadswords, with neither allowed to pass over a line in the center. These conditions were intended to mock the idea of the duel, especially since Lincoln was so much taller than Shields, but Shields persisted. On September 22, 1842, Lincoln, Shields, their seconds, and others boasted across the Mississippi River to fight the duel on Missouri soil, where, unlike in Illinois, dueling was still legal. Fortunately, friends intervened to get Shields to accept Lincoln's explanation, and the duel was called off, but Lincoln was mortified by this episode. Shields's and Lincoln's letters and all of the details were publicized, and the dueling business and spirit raged in Springfield afterward. We can rightly suppose that Shields's Masonic brothers knew all about this affair and possibly assisted him. It is worth noting that one of the letters which so angered Shields was published in Springfield newspaper on September 2, 1842, and the very next day Lincoln delivered a speech at the Masonic Memorial Service for his late friend Bowling Green at the invitation probably made in July before the anti-Shields letters were published of the Springfield Lodge. Then, a letter that was even more insulting to Shields was printed in the newspaper on September 9th, and the parties met and almost fought their duel on September 22nd. It is likely that there was a good deal of tension between Lincoln and Shields' Lodge brothers at this time. Lincoln had been in a highly public feud with one of the leading members of the Lodge. This might have made him reluctant to join the Masonic Lodge to which Shields and his friends belonged, and they might have rejected him if he had petitioned. This episode, plus the one involving James Adams, might have left Lincoln with a negative feeling about Masons in general. Other possible reasons for Lincoln not joining Freemasonry. Another possible reason for Lincoln's not becoming a Mason may have been political. In the 1830s, there was a very strong anti-Masonic feeling, and even an anti-Masonic party that had elected some of its members to state and federal positions. Some politicians gained favor in office by attacking Masonry. Many lodges lost members and folded. Becoming a Mason could harm political careers, and even some former Masons took an anti-Masonic attitude in their speeches. Lincoln might have decided to avoid the opposition of anti-Masons by not joining Freemasonry. However, it should be noted that the anti-Masonic party had minimal influence in Illinois and neighboring states, and that its influence was largely ended at the time Lincoln might have been expected to consider becoming a Mason. Lincoln may have decided not to seek to join Masons because he thought that it would be misconstrued as an attempt to obtain political support from other Masons, or he may have truly felt himself unworthy, too lazy to properly perform his Masonic duties if he joined, or he may have been too busy with his regular business activities, or he may have had poor views of Masons because of his prominent feuds with two of them, or he may have felt that those feuds would lead to his rejection if he tried to join, or he may have felt that the anti-Masons would not have supported his political ambitions if he became a Mason, or perhaps he may have just been indifferent towards Freemasonry. Perhaps the real reason was some combination. Certainly, Freemasonry lost the opportunity to include among its members someone who would have fit very well into the Masonic philosophy and who could have assisted Freemasonry if he had been so chosen. Perhaps Lincoln also lost something by not becoming a member of Freemasons, the opportunity to join with others in an organization seeking many of the same basic goals that motivated Abraham Lincoln throughout his life. How did Masonry affect Lincoln? Masonry's influence on Lincoln through the Declaration of Independence. It is not possible to know if, or how, or to what extent Abraham Lincoln was affected directly or indirectly by Masonry. Some guesses are reasonable, though. Freemasonry was especially strong in the 1700s, and its philosophy and goals had a strong influence on the founding fathers of the United States, many of whom, such as George Washington and Benjamin Franklin, were active, enthusiastic, and prominent Masons who applied their Masonic ideals in their work. The Declaration of Independence in 1776 stated a fundamental position that was developed in Masonry earlier in the 1700s. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Lincoln, in 1861, said, quote, "I have never had a feeling, politically, that did not spring from the sentiments embodied on the Declaration of Independence. I have often inquired of myself what great principles or ideas it was that kept this Confederacy so long together. It was that sentiment in the Declaration of Independence which gave liberty not alone to the people of this country, but hope to the world for all future time. It was that which gave promise that in due time and the weights should be lifted from the shoulders of all men, and that all should have an equal chance." End quote. This is the guiding spirit of the Masonic philosophy, then and now, and it became a part of the Declaration of Independence that in turn affected Lincoln so fundamentally. Masonry's possible influence on Lincoln's political career. At least one author believes Lincoln's middle position between Masonry and the anti-Masonry may have helped him gain the Republican nomination for president in 1860. All his major opponents, William H. Seward of New York, Salmon P. Chase of Ohio, and Edward Bates of Missouri, had anti-Masonic histories. Masons, and there were definitely some at the nominating convention, would have been more inclined toward Lincoln than the others. Except for Lincoln, all the candidates for president in 1860 were Masons: Stephen A. Douglas, John C. Breckinridge, and John Bell. The president then, James Buchanan, and other prominent political leaders were also Masons. The list of prominent people connected with the Civil War and politics in that era who were Masons is very long, including Winfield Scott, George B. McClellan, Robert Anderson, Winfield Scott Hancock, Benjamin F. Butler, Simon Cameron, Lewis Cass, John G. Crittenden, Andrew G. Curtin, David G. Farragut, Nathaniel P. Banks, John A. McClernand, Thomas H. Benton, John A. Logan, Sam Houston, Stephen A. Hurlbut, Andrew Johnson, Edward M. Stanton, Gideon Wells, Albert Sidney Johnston, P.G.T. Beauregard, Howell Cobb, John B. Floyd, Albert Pike, Sterling Price, Robert Toombs, Godfrey Witzel, Henry A. Weiss. It is possible that Lincoln saw some of the spirit of brotherly friendship among these Masons, and that their practice of Masonic ideals had some effect on him. Moral influences. It is well known that Lincoln demonstrated magnanimity even toward his enemies, asking in his second inaugural address for malice toward none and charity for all, and desiring an easy peace and for the leaders of the Confederate government to be allowed to escape rather than being arrested and condemned, and his visits and friendly comments to Confederate wounded. Lincoln searched for reasons to reverse the decisions of court-martials calling for executions. Freemasonry also played a role in alleviating the harshness of the Civil War, and this probably came to Lincoln's attention and may have affected his own attitudes to some extent. Masons from both sides got together to exchange information, assist wounded from the other side, and arrange for Masonic burial services for fallen enemies. Some soldiers even escaped death because of their Masonic affiliation. Lincoln and his colleagues, who were Freemasons, demonstrated charity toward others even while engaging in all-out combat to accomplish goals they felt were worth fighting for, to maintain democratic government, and to prove that people could govern themselves. Abraham Lincoln was never a Mason, but it is likely that Masonry had some positive influences on him, and he on Freemasonry. His political philosophy was affected by Masonic ideals through the Masonic influence on the Declaration of Independence and the United States Constitution. His spirit of charity during the Civil War was probably affected to some extent by hearing how Masons in the war helped each other while maintaining their ideas. Lincoln was helped in his personal life and his political activities by Masons, from his days in the New Salem through the rest of his life. Without overreaching, Masons and all who study Lincoln can rightly take some satisfaction from the involvement of Abraham Lincoln, a non-Mason, in Freemasonry. Alright, so that is the piece on Abe Lincoln and Freemasonry by Paul Bessel. I hope you enjoyed that one. The bibliography and citations for this one as well are a few pages long, so we'll make sure that we have those posted in the app, and through the app you can download the papers again. A final thank you once more to our producers and Patreon subscribers. However you choose to support the show, we thank you very much. That's it for this week. If you like Masonic podcasts, please check out the Masonic Roundtable every Thursday at 8:30 Central, 9:30 Eastern. Check out the Midnight Freemasons Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays for new Masonic content every single week. And until next week, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson. Take care.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.